Book of Esther. If you find Psalms, just start back and up to your left, and you'll go through Job, and eventually you'll bump into Esther. On any given night, at a bowling alley, somewhere in America, you'll find somebody who has bowled a 300. That's a perfect game. I think Bernie Rabb's husband did that one time, maybe more than once, a long time ago. That's 12 consecutive strikes, and you get a perfect game. However, for a competitive bowler, the holy grail of bowling is a perfect series. That is a 900, three consecutive perfect games. There have only been 21 perfect series recorded in the history of bowling. On January 18th, 2010, a man named Bill Fong was three rolls away from a perfect series. It was league night at the Plano Super Bowl. Bill Fong had rolled 33 consecutive strikes. His crowd of fellow league members stopped everything to watch. As on frame 34, he gathered up his ball, he walked up to the line and rolled the ball and whacked another strike. And then on frame 35, the crowd went wild as he bowled another strike. One more strike for the perfect series. But something wasn't quite right. Because two frames back, Bill had begun sweating profusely and feeling dizzy. But when you're one strike away from a perfect series, you don't quit. So as any typical athlete would do, he shook it off, grabbed his ball, and stood up to the line and took his usual five steps, released the ball perfectly. The crowd started to applaud before the ball even reached the pins because it was released so perfectly. It took the curve just exactly as it was supposed to make. It made contact with the pins precisely at the spot where it's supposed to, as it had been for all of the previous strikes. Pins flew, the crowd cheered. But the number one pin wobbled in its place and finally settled in its stand. 899 was the final score. One lousy pin away from perfection. Well, understandably heartbroken, Bill went home. Still feeling the dizziness, not feeling well, went into his bathroom and vomited. The walls were spinning. Bill was having a stroke. He'd already been struggling with high blood pressure, and the events of that exciting night at the bowling alley turned a delicate situation into a potentially deadly one. Bill never realized, actually, that he'd suffered a stroke until he had another one later, and that's when he finally went to the hospital. And that's when the doctor found the scar tissue from the previous stroke, and then the doctor was told about that exciting night at the bowling alley, when Bill came that close to the 900. But the doctor believed very sincerely that the only thing that saved Bill's life that night was the 899, that one pin standing. The doctor is certain that had that number pin fallen and Bill bowled that perfect game, that his body, already in the midst of a stroke, would have pushed his blood pressure even higher, and he most likely would have died right there immediately at lane 28. And so what felt like the worst possible thing that could have happened to him turned out to be the thing that most likely saved his life. Providence? Perhaps. Was God responsible for keeping that number 10 pin standing? I don't know, perhaps. But I do know that among the many things that characterize God, one of those is His providence. Providence, to put it in a simple definition, is just God's attention concentrated everywhere. God's attention concentrated everywhere. That's a wonderful thought. To think that every moment, every place, God's attention is focused. Now, that's what we're going to see in the book of Esther, and we're going to spend 4 Sundays. The 19th, we have a Gideon speaker, so I'll have just one brief interruption there. But then we're going to spend 4 Sundays in the book of Esther. And I've given this introductory lesson the title, The Secretive Sovereignty of God. Now, why do I call it secretive sovereignty? Well, mainly because we don't always see His sovereignty. Or we don't always know when it's at work. And the other reason is the fact that one of the controversial characteristics of the book of Esther is that God's name is not mentioned at all. And so that's why some individuals doubt that it belongs in the Word of God. But even though God's name is not mentioned anywhere throughout the pages of this great book, His sovereign will is mysteriously accomplished through the people and through the events that are involved in this intriguing and dramatic story. And we'll see how God performs His perfect will. And so I'd like you to journey with me back to an ancient time in Persia and learn how God works in unusual ways to accomplish His providential plan on behalf of His people. And so if I just begin here at verse 1, let me introduce this with these first 2 verses. Now, it took place in the days of King Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was the citadel or at the citadel in Susa. Now, I'll just stop there for just a moment. King Ahasuerus. Now, I'm going to tell you up front, I have difficulty pronouncing that name. And if I have to keep saying it, my mouth gets contorted and it doesn't come out right. So Ahasuerus, that actually is a Hebrew name. It's the Hebrew transliteration of his Persian name, which is even harder to pronounce, Kashishara or something. It looks like Kardashian to me, but that's... So if you want to go with that one, but everybody knows how to pronounce it, but I'm not crazy about that one. So I'm going with his Greek name, which is Xerxes, even though it's spelled weird. It's easier to pronounce. This is King Xerxes the First. So from here on out, if you want to go with Ahasuerus, I applaud you. Do it. If you want Kardashian, I'm sorry for you. But I'm going with Xerxes, so... If you're good with that, we'll be a happier crowd together here. But Xerxes was the king of Persia, and this took place during, of course, the lifetime of Esther. You probably would recognize the name of his grandfather, Cyrus. Cyrus the Great, king of Persia. Cyrus was the one who conquered the Babylonians and built Persia into the great empire and world power that it was. And then Cyrus's son, Darius the First, took over. He didn't last very long, and he was eventually murdered. And eventually, Xerxes took over for his father, Darius the First. And Xerxes reigned for 21 years over the Persian Empire, from 486 to 465 B.C., until he died by assassination. So it was never really a healthy thing to become the emperor, but he did reign. Now, if I were to pick 2 words that might characterize King Xerxes, the words I chose would be arrogant and self-indulgent. And that probably describes pretty much all of the emperors of great empires, because they all tend to become rather arrogant and self-indulgent. But one of Xerxes' problems was he drank too much, and he loved to throw great big parties that included a great amount of drunkenness and lewd behavior. But one of the interesting things that we will observe is that God used one of the king's wild parties to set in motion the events that would eventually lead to Esther becoming his queen. And we'll get to that in a moment. But Xerxes was not only drunk with wine, he was drunk with power. During his reign, the empire stretched, as we saw, from India to Ethiopia, covering 127 provinces. There was no one on earth more powerful than he. And he knew it. He just wasn't very successful at what he did. He did manage to conquer Egypt, but he failed miserably in his effort to invade Greece and Europe in order to make himself the emperor of the world. But at least he still ruled over Persia, the largest empire of the world at that particular time. So with that knowledge as our background, I want to leave you with just three basic introductory lessons for today. Three basic introductory lessons. Lesson number one is, God can providentially use even sinful people to accomplish his purposes. That sounds rather strange, doesn't it? But it's true. Throughout the Bible, we have seen how God does that. He can use sinful people, sinful events, to accomplish his more holy or divine purposes in this world. A moment ago, I said that God used a wild drunken party thrown by King Xerxes to set in motion the events that would lead to Esther, a Jew, becoming queen of Persia. Very unusual. Now, did that really happen? Yeah, it did. Now, as we read on in chapter 1, we find out how circumstances began to work to get Esther to become queen, and you're familiar with this story, I'm sure. But picking up at verse 3, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being in his presence. You ever notice how the media shows up everywhere, you know? Gee. Verse 4, and he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now, I'll jump down to verse 7. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. And let's just slide down to verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, that means he was plastered, by the way, he commanded these 7 guys, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce, these 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Xerxes, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come. The king, to come at the king's demand or command, I can't even read, let alone pronounce words. But she refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. The king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Now, for a long time when I was younger, I used to think that Queen Vashti was kind of a stubborn grouch of a woman, you know, just difficult. Not coming when the king asked her to come. So she was just being ornery. But I later changed my opinion of her when I began to understand a little more about the circumstances that surrounded this. And we should first understand something about the debauchery that was taking place here. The king is intoxicated. He'd been drinking for 7 days and around all these other men at his drunken party. And he calls for his wife, Queen Vashti, to be brought into the presence of all of these other drunken men so he could show off her beauty to them. Now, I always wondered what's wrong with that. You know, she's beautiful and he wants everybody to see that. Well, how about just the simple fact that she was his wife? Just start there. She's his wife. And he is demanding that she be paraded in front of a group of drunken men for one purpose only, so they can all lust after her. Do you do that to a wife? I mean, it's one thing to be proud of your trophy wife and to be proud walking down the street with her on your arm. But it's quite another thing to treat her as a public object of sensual desire. That's just plain degrading and wrong. And that's what this king was doing. Now, some scholars who've studied the history and everything much deeper than I have suggest that the request that she come wearing her crown meant that she was to come wearing only her crown, if you know what that indicates. If that is true, then we should know that no woman should ever be subject to something so disgraceful and so dehumanizing. And especially a husband who would demand such a thing from his wife, whether he's drunk or sober, has no sense of love and respect, much less of reason or common sense. But at least we know the context out of which God is going to work. He's going to work his divine plan through this circumstance. Now, Vashti refused the command, and rightly so. I believe she did the exact thing that she should have done. But this obviously embarrassed the king in front of his peers. And being embarrassed, he's enraged. And so because he's intoxicated and angry, he behaves rather irrationally. He consulted with his advisors on what he should do. What should I do with this queen who is being so rebellious against me? And the advice that he'd given is that he depose her as queen and divorce her. Just get rid of this woman. She's poison. Now, I love their male reasoning here at verse 17. This is what they're saying. Here's their rationale for dumping the queen. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to the king's princess, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. See what they're saying? We gotta nip this in the bud right now, because if we let her get away with this, every woman in the empire is going to start to treat their husband in the same way, and they'll all be contemptuous, and we're going to have a whole country full of angry, rebellious women. So we got to stop this right now. And so Xerxes did as they advised. He dumped Queen Vashti, and then he enacted a new law that said from this point on, every man is the master of his house, and every woman is expected to obey their husbands. That's the law. And that's going to solve it all. And that's what his advisors even said down in verse 20. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. It's going to solve all the problems now. We've got the women under control. Nobody said amen to that, did you? You men are cowards. You're right. Rather comical situation, but sad circumstances nonetheless. But as I mentioned, we will see how God used corrupt behavior and irrational actions of men to later put Esther, a Jewish woman, on the throne as queen of Persia, but not just to put her on the throne. The whole purpose, we will see, is to ultimately save his people, Israel, from destruction. God is seeing farther down the road. Now, that brings us to another lesson. Sometimes we suffer for doing what is right. Sometimes we suffer for it. We're not always going to get the trophies or the pat on the back or the commendation. You do the right thing before God, the press isn't going to write a good story about you all the time. And Queen Vashti was not a believer in God, as far as we know. She was a Persian, so that would indicate that she was more subject to the pagan religions of Persia. But she did the right thing morally when she refused to participate in this obscene demand of her husband. Now, I understand the biblical understanding or the biblical definition of the role of husband and wife, and I know Paul's writings in Ephesians 5, and I know the submission thing, and I know the mutual respect and all of that. But this situation here regarding this man and his wife is way out of bounds. It doesn't fit the biblical definition. And so in the midst of an unpleasant and offensive scene, she was brave enough to say no to something that was so blatantly wrong and immoral. She resisted the indignity and took a stand against the greatest, most powerful human being in the world at the time. And it cost her dearly. But I applaud her. I respect her for what she did. And maybe it just should serve as a bit of encouragement to all of us to do the right thing before God in all circumstances, regardless of what it will cost you. And I would say, especially even to young women, to girls, you will face all kinds of temptations and all kinds of encouragements to do that which is wrong. But hold your ground. Because if you give in to some of those demands, you will have a lifetime of regret. And I say that not with a spirit of judgmentalism or condemnation. I say it with a heart of compassion and love for you. Because I want you to have a life that is pleasing and satisfied. Well, let's move to the third lesson. God maintains sovereign rule over all earthly authorities. All authorities. All authority in the human realm comes from God, whether man recognizes it or not. Everyone is in place by God's permission. And he alone is in complete control. He proved that throughout history. He proved it with Pharaoh in Egypt. He proved it with Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He proved it with Sennacherib in Jerusalem. He proved it with Herod the First at the time of the birth of Jesus. And through all history, in every ruler and every emperor, every king, every president, God has maintained sovereign control, even to this very day. I want you to listen for a moment as I just read for you what Nebuchadnezzar declared at a time when he was in his right mind. He wasn't in his right mind most of the time, but God dealt with him in a rather harsh, severe way, and this is what he came to ultimately say about God. Daniel 4, verse 35. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? I could even include verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his words are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Unfortunately for Nebuchadnezzar, he had to learn that the hard way after God very severely humbled him. But what he said here is exactly true. Solomon declared something very similar in Proverbs 21, verse 1. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. Channels of water. That reminded me of the time when I was a young boy. The neighborhood we lived in at that time, the roads were all gravel roads. And boy, those roads could get dusty when it got dry, and in the times when it would rain and they would get traveled on, they would get rough until the grader would come through and smooth the road out. But during the times when it was all rough and full of holes and hard gravel and packed down, and we'd get a heavy rain, I used to always like to go out in the road with a stick or a shovel with those puddles of water, and I would dig little channels, and I would drain one puddle into another puddle and make it a bigger one, and I would drain that one into another puddle and make a bigger one until that overflowed, and then as it overflowed, I would carve another channel and turn the water this way, or if there was another stream that was flowing down into the ditch, I would dam it up and I would route another one. It didn't take me much to entertain me as a child, as you know, but that was a good time. Just out there rerouting those puddles. Till I got about close to high school, then they put curb and gutter in and paved the roads. And so by then I had outgrown that fun anyway. I was into driving cars then. But the point is, that's the way God works with the rulers of the world. His sovereign divine hand just carves the little channels throughout the ages of history and time and routes the king's hearts wherever he wants them to go. Warren Wiersbe reminds us that every man or woman in a place of authority is second in command, for Jesus Christ is Lord of all. Now that doesn't mean, of course, that corrupt rulers can't do bad things and inflict terrible suffering upon people. They do. We know that. Some are doing it right now. And we live under the threat right now of what some evil dictator wants to do. But God always keeps them on a leash, no matter who they are, no matter what they do. And as we saw in point one, God can still use foolish and evil men and women and terrible circumstances that they may do to accomplish his will and his purpose. And so my advice to you this morning simply is, don't fall into the trap of thinking that God is asleep or disinterested or disconnected when it comes to the nations of the world or the foolishness of politicians and national leaders. He knows what's going on, and he can change things in a moment if he wants to. But likewise, don't be duped into thinking that he is out of touch with the affairs of your personal life. He's not out of touch. He is interested. He's engaged. And here's one of the facts about the secretive sovereignty of God, or his providence, if you will. This is something you can engrave in stone or write down in indelible ink. The simple truth that God is always at work. He's at work in the mundane things as much as he is in the sensational things. His providence rules in the tragedies of life as much as it does in the victories of life. We just have to relax and remember, as Isaiah the prophet reminded us, that his ways are not our ways. And that means his timing is not according to our schedules. And if we can remember that, then our anxiety level will decrease significantly, and our confidence in God will increase. And it might just be that our blood pressure will go down too. Father, thank you.